Very briefly in Ezra chapter 4, and then we're going to be moving through chapters 5 and 6. There's a possibility, I'm hoping for, we might even get a little bit farther this evening, but we'll settle for those two. That's actually the schedule. As you're turning there, though, I would like to have everybody direct your attention to the screen, as I have only one additional photograph than I had last week, and so we're just going to get these out of the way very quickly. You know, here's a couple slides, same ones you saw last week, except for this one that you see right here. While these are not Temple Mount walls, and they are not temple walls, still yet the people are building in the book of Ezra, or supposed to be, and in the book of Ezra then, a construction that's going to be somewhat similar to this from the standpoint that it is stone that is being, you know, set in place. Photographs, that this one and the one that follows, I took year before last, not this last trip, but back in 2017. And so I've been trying to put up a different photograph each week as a cover or title slide, you know, so we just get an idea of what the Jews are involved in. But as you look at these walls, I'd like for you to, you know, to answer the question, how tall do you think they are? This is the north wall of what's called the Old City of Jerusalem. It's much more extensive than this, but it's just one part of it. And so you look at that, and it's really just impossible to get the scale. So look really close at the real center of that. I'm going to now zoom, that's not quite center, I guess, but we're going to zoom into that area, exactly that area right there. So take a look at how small that area is in comparison to the rest of that wall. And then as you zoom in on this picture, guess what you see there? Now that gives you some kind of an idea of how gigantic these walls really are. And I'm really curious, what is that door? That steel door with all the locks on it and the concrete, you know, that they set in there. Who is this man? What is his purpose? You know, in the inner reaches here, you know what that's all about. And I have no idea on this one. I'm going to go back to that first picture. I was just kind of surprised that I even noticed when I walked in that, you know, I needed something for scale. A tree really didn't help. And then I spied this guy taking his afternoon nap. So it gives you something of the scope. And in a little while, we'll be talking about the size of the temple that they're rebuilding. So we'll kind of come back again to structures that are large. Here is the timeline we've been talking about. Please note that the book of Ezra here, from 538 to 516, it says chapters 1 through 6. And then with a big split, you have Ezra chapter 7 through 10. And then the single year of 457 that's being described there. So the book, the reason why we're stopping at chapter 6, is divided into two really big parts separated by a large chunk of time. Ezra himself, apparently the author of the book, is not involved in these first six chapters. He actually will speak of himself back here, you know, in the second part of the book. So we'll come to him here a few weeks in the future. Remember, I pointed out that we have lots of problems with the kings in the Medo-Persia or Persia. We have Darius the Mede, Darius the First, Ahasuerus, also called Xerxes. There's Artaxerxes. There's more than one Artaxerxes. There are some really serious, I think, unresolvable questions in the among the statements that Ezra makes, and precisely when these things took place, what king we're talking about, simply because we haven't got enough non-biblical historical information to help us understand what's going on there. Don't let it trouble you. People make big noise about it, you know, but we've already seen time and again in Daniel, we see it also in this book already, that virtually all the Jews, I suppose absolutely all the Jews, had two names. They would have a Babylonian name given to them when they're taken captive and a Jewish name that their parents had given them before they were taken captive. For those that have built the houses, as Jeremiah said that they should, and that they should marry and have families, and so they took Jeremiah's advice in preparation for this terrible exile, you know, they've raised those families, and the Jewish parents are not going to give their kids Babylonian names, now are they? No. But the Babylonians are not going to be real fond of having these Jewish names rising up above them, among them, and so there's always going to be two names. And then even among the Gentiles, it's the same thing. we're just unfamiliar with the way things are working back there. So don't let, you know, these things trouble you at all. I don't spend a lot of time on them anyway. Someday there'll be some uninspired literature come to light and probably solve all those problems, explain why Ezra did what he did so long ago. But I failed last week to point something out. I would like for you to make a note. Back in chapter 4 at verse 7. In chapter 4 and verse 7, in the days of Artaxerxes, Bishlam, Mithridat, Tabeel, and the rest of his colleagues wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and the text of the letter was written in what? Aramaic. Translated from the Aramaic. So they have a letter that was sent off to get the building of the temple stopped. They succeed in kind of hoodwinking the current king into thinking that it's a rebellion, and so by force of arms they're told to cease and desist, don't be building on the temple anymore. But it's in Aramaic. So if you'd like to make a note, just like Daniel, and in your Bible, only elsewhere in Daniel, the Aramaic language appears in Ezra at two different places. So what I did, I drew a line, you know, in my margin. Remember, I've got an inch and a half margin. So I drew a line, I've got start Aramaic. But just so you know what it is, Aramaic in Ezra chapter 4, verse 8, as we've just been told, 4 verse 8 through chapter 6, 18, which we'll come to later this evening. So there's that section of Ezra that's Aramaic, chapter 4, verse 8 through 6, 18. And then also in Ezra, chapter 7, verses 12 through 26. And we saw this with Daniel as well, and I think we have exactly the same explanation. This is a letter that's going off to a Persian king. So naturally, it needs to be in the language of that king. And so not in Hebrew then. That would be, you know, the more appropriate Jewish language of the time. But it also involves things like Daniel's Aramaic section does that involves directly the Gentiles. So those things are of more personal nature to the Jews, of course, being Hebrew. And then we got the same thing as with Daniel, sometimes Aramaic. So these are the only two places in Scripture, two books in Scripture, that will have a portion of Aramaic in them. Hebrew for the vast majority of the Old Testament, of course Greek for the original language of the New Testament. Okay, so you begin the Aramaic there, and therefore, as we start chapter 5, we are in the midst of an Aramaic section. That letter's been sent out, and at the tail end, the last verse in chapter 4, the work on the house of God in Jerusalem ceased. It was stopped until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So, I mentioned then we do have some questions about timelines and kings' names and those sorts of things there, and it's kind of a thorny one, these last couple of verses there. But still, there's no doubt that the work was stopped. So, we come to chapter 5. When the prophets Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them, then Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel and Jeshua the son of Jozadak arose and began to build the house of God which is in Jerusalem. And the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. At that time, Tatnai, the governor beyond the river, and Shethar-Bozenai and their colleagues came to them and spoke to them thus. Now, brother, this is somewhat different. I think you'll notice it in the verbiage. They had enemies with a chip on their shoulder that were misrepresenting what was going on and wanted them stopped in the preceding chapter. They have succeeded. As a matter of fact, they've succeeded for 16 years. 16 years. But in this case, we've had 16 years go by, and while that foundation's been laid and those structures been built upon it, by force of arms, they were prohibited from going any further. This Haggai and Zechariah show up, and they stimulate the people to get going again. This time, the overlords of the Jews back in Jerusalem, Persian overlords, they are not angry. They're inquisitive. They're just wanting to find out. So, you know, it's been 16 years, and this is typical in a lot of politics, and maybe worse where so much assassination goes on in those days. You know, people change over, And so it's 16 years later, and they're just wondering, what are you doing? So see how this reads. It's not so confrontational. At the end of verse 3, who issued you a decree to rebuild this temple and to finish this structure? We just want to know, where did you get this idea? Then we told them, accordingly, what the names of the men were who were reconstructing this building. But the eye of their God was on the elders of the Jews, and they did not stop them until a report should come to Darius, and then a written reply be returned concerning it. So this time, their building is not interrupted. They just keep on keeping on. There's going to be the passage of some time, the transfers of letters, you know, to the far distant kingdom of Persia is going to take some time, and then the king has to find time to address the issue. They're going to have to do some research, you know, their records to see about it, and then somebody's going to have to come all the way back, you know, with a decision. So when we get to chapter 6, you're going to read about Ecbatana. See how far that is from Jerusalem. It's an enormous distance. And what lies between on this map? The dread desert. And so they're going to have to go up around the Fertile Crescent to come down, which is likely going to be as much as doubling what would be an extremely long distance, even if they could go in a straight line. So we're going to have the passage of time here as a resolution of the question is sought. So the eyes of their God was upon them. Now, verse 6, this is the copy of the letter which Tatnai, the governor of the province beyond the river, and Shethar-Boznai and his colleagues, the officials who were beyond the river, sent to Darius the king. They sent a report to him in which it was written thus. So in the middle of verse 7, the letter itself starts. We've had an Aramaic section, and so it just flows into the letter itself in Aramaic, which says, to Darius the king, all peace. Let it be known to the king that we have gone to the province of Judah, to the house of the great God, which is being built with huge stones and beams are being laid in the walls. And this work is going on with great care and is succeeding in their hands. Now, stop. I set you up here. This work is going on with great care and is succeeding in their hands. Who started this work? Maybe if I ask you this way, who kick-started this work? Two prophets. Who are they? Haggai and Zechariah. They are the ones that count the most in all of this. In the first verse, Haggai the prophet, Zechariah the son of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem, and then Zerubbabel arose and rebuilt the house. So Zechariah and Haggai put an end to 16 years of just letting it lie. And now they've gotten really busy. Those two men show up and they are highly motivational. They got this entire nation of Jews back online and on their job site. And now it's described here in verse 8. It's a great God which is being built with huge stones and beams are being laid in the walls. This work is going on with great care and is succeeding in their hands. They're impressed with what they see. Then we ask, verse 9, then we ask those elders and said to them thus, who issued you a decree to rebuild the temple and to finish this structure? We also asked them their names so as to inform you, and that we might write down the names of the men who are at their head. Thus they answered us, saying, we are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and are rebuilding the temple that was built many years ago, which a great king of Israel built and finished. Who was that king? Solomon was the great king that built the first temple. But, verse 12, because our fathers had provoked the God of heaven to wrath, he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, the Chaldean, who destroyed this temple and deported the people to Babylon. However, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, King Cyrus issued a decree to rebuild the house of God. Now, Cyrus here is called the king of Babylon. How long had he been king of Babylon when he issues this decree? Well, no more than 3 years. Something less, actually. He was actually the king of Medo-Persia, which had just conquered the Babylonian Empire. So now he's the king of Babylon, but that's an overnight thing. That takes place back in Daniel chapter 5. Belshazzar's drunk, you know, handwriting on the wall. Next morning he's dead and the kingdom passes to this Cyrus. So they're telling the story we've already studied in the book of Daniel. Verse 14, and also the gold and silver utensils of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, brought them to the temple of Babylon. These King Cyrus took from the temple of Babylon, and they were given to one whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he had appointed governor. Now, we talked about this last week, but I want to, you know, remind you again. It is apparent, brethren, that Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel are what? The same guy. Sheshbazzar is his Aramaic or exiled captive Babylonish name. Zerubbabel is the name the Jews had given him. So here's Sheshbazzar, but we've already been reading about Zerubbabel. We went over last week, looked in Zechariah, and saw that in Ezra it says Sheshbazzar laid the foundation. In Zechariah it says Zerubbabel did it. Apparently they're the same guy. We're going by two different names, and you see why, you know, we have these various consistency problems here with the language differences. But they're mentioning Sheshbazzar. Why would they use that name instead of Zerubbabel? Because this is the Aramaic name, this is the captive's name, this is the Babylonish name, this is the name that's going to sound more familiar and maybe appear in records back there in the capital of the Medo-Persian Empire. So in verse 15 he said to him, by the way, the Medo-Persians actually had three capital cities, and the king, at least one of them, is known to have spent, three separate periods. He'd dedicate 4 months, I guess, if it was even, but he would dedicate a certain amount of time to each of these three capitals, of which Susa is one, Ecbatana is the other, and, you know, off the top of my head, I forget now. I don't think it's Babylon, I forget what the other, maybe it's Persepolis. I think it is Persepolis. So at any rate, they're splitting their time. So it makes perfect sense. And therefore helps to explain why we've got two names for the same guy, too. And he said, verse 15, take these utensils, go deposit them in the temple in Jerusalem, let the house of God be rebuilt in its place. Then that Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundations of the house of God in Jerusalem, and from then until now, it has been under construction, and it is not completed. Now, if it pleases the king, let a search be conducted in the king's treasure house, which is there in Babylon. So at this point in time, at least, he's in Babylon. If it be that a decree was issued by King Cyrus to rebuild this house of God at Jerusalem, and let the king send to us his decision concerning this matter. So, verse 1, he issues a decree. So we have this letter. Nobody's mad. Nobody's got a point of view. It's been 16 years. They got busy again. We just want to know, how do you feel about it, O king? You're a different king. You know, the whole thing's changed hands, different emperor. How do you feel about this? So we know what to do back here as we're ruling over these people. Okay, so you see what I mean? The chapter's really easy. Anybody have any questions about chapter 5? It's straightforward history. So let's see the end of the story now in chapter 6. The king, Darius, issued a decree. Search was made in the archives where the treasures were stored in Babylon. And in Ecbatana, in the fortress, which is in the province of Media, a scroll was found. There was in it as follows, memorandum. So, while the king is over here on the banks of the Euphrates in Babylon at the moment, and when I say they reign from three, you know, capitals, they're traveling all the time. They've got wars on the frontiers and everything. You know, kings are busy. He's there, but where are the records? Ecbatana. There's probably records scattered through a number of different cities so that the king, regardless of what palace he's in, can have access to records. In this case, that search then may have been fairly extensive. Not just in Babylon, but had to make a serious journey over to Ecbatana, you know, and maybe other places, trying to find out, are these supposed records in existence. They were. Verse 3. In the first year of King Cyrus, Cyrus the king issued a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. Let the temple, the place where sacrifices are offered, be rebuilt. Let its foundations be retained, its height being. Now, you may need a note to help you remember this one. Its height being 60 cubits, its width 60 cubits. Stop. What are we reading in these verses? What are we reading? What is the last word in verse 2?
A memorandum
that was found in what city? Ecbatana. And in Ecbatana, are we reading Jewish records? Whose records are we reading? We are reading what the Medo-Persians said. So, don't let anybody pull the wool over your eyes and make some kind of big stink again. The end of verse 3 is not the dimensions of the temple they built. It is also not a contradiction. This says its height being 60 cubits, its width 60 cubits. Okay? That's not what they built. What they built was considerably smaller. This would be 90 by 90. So how do we account for this discrepancy? The remodel I did on the house here, you know, just a half mile away, this remodel was my 48th building project. I've been involved in a lot of building in the course of my life. So that was my 48th building project. Now, what did I have to get before I could drive my first nail? A building permit. This memorandum, brethren, I believe, is not any kind of contradiction, but we have records that are at least 16 years old over here in Ecbatana from a preceding emperor, the Medo-Persian Empire, and it looks to me like this is what he wrote on the building permit. I'll allow you to go 90 by 90. Did they go 90 by 90? No. But this does not make a contradiction in Scripture. Only the ignorant, you know, or those with, you know, some sort of agenda will, you know, seize upon this. But it's a favorite, you know, among people who don't want to believe the Bible. Seems like an obvious discrepancy of some kind. Well, it's not. That's what the king said about it. That's what the king was allowing. It's not what they actually built. And that's a perfect harmony with the way things work. So you might just want to make a note there. You know, this is what I call the building permit the Cyrus issued. Yes?
Well, I'm curious, where did we see that it wasn't that big?
You know, that's a great question, and off the top of my head, I don't remember, and I wish I'd put a note here, but I don't know where it is. I can tell you this.
Wasn't that the dimensions of the original temple?
Well, I can tell you, yeah. And I made another note, and I was just coming to that in verse 3. In the first year of King Cyrus, you know, let's rebuild 60 by 60. I made the note, Solomon's temple was 60 by 20 by 30 cubits high. So it was in the vicinity of 90 feet long, 30 feet wide, 45 feet tall. Okay? Which is kind of common, surprisingly, these extremely tall temple structures, taller than it is wide. So 60 by 20 by 30, and there it's 1 Kings 6, verse 3, that we're told that. When they build this foundation, and they're apparently not expanding on it, they're just now putting, you know, the structure up on top of the foundation they built, was it larger or smaller than Solomon's? It was smaller. We're told it's smaller in Israel. We're going to see it again. So, I'm forgetting the exact dimensions. Bill, why do you have to embarrass me like this? You ask me questions, things I'm supposed to know, and then when I don't, you call me out in front of all these people. So, obviously, I should have laughed at it, but I thought the same thing. I should dig that out, and then I just didn't do it. So, call it lazy. I'll see if I can find it later. But, at any rate, we know this temple to be smaller than Solomon's. Solomon's was 60 by 20 by 30, according to 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 3. So Cyrus has apparently issued this building permit. I just don't need that slide up there anymore. So in verse 4, he continues to describe it with three layers of huge stones and one layer of timbers, and let the cost be paid from the royal treasury. Also let the gold and silver utensils of the temple of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took from the temple in Jerusalem, brought to Babylon, be returned, brought to their places in the temple in Jerusalem. You shall put them in the house of God. Now, Tatnai, governor of the province beyond the river, Shethar Boznai, and your colleagues, the officials of the provinces beyond the river, keep away from there. Leave this work on the house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews, the elders of the Jews, rebuild this house of God on its site. Moreover, I issue a decree concerning what you're to do for these elders of Judah in the rebuilding of this house of God. The full cost is to be paid to these people from the royal treasury out of the taxes beyond the river. They've added in italics the provinces, which is certainly very helpful in this case. So the taxes of provinces that are beyond the river, and that without delay. Whatever's needed, both young bulls, rams, and lambs for a burnt offering to the God of heaven, and wheat, salt, wine, and anointing oil, as the priest in Jerusalem requests, is to be given to them daily without fail, that they may offer acceptable sacrifices to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. Now, two reasons are given for Medo-Persia footing the bill on what would be, certainly in the Jews' minds, a very rival God and his temple in Jerusalem. What are the two reasons? Number one, both in verse 10, offer acceptable sacrifices to the God of heaven. Interesting, he would put it that way. And pray for the life of the king and his sons, which we happen to know from what records have been discovered from such time frames and such royal circumstances. This is very common among people who are very comfortable being idolaters and worshiping innumerable gods. To them, what does Yahweh look like? Just another local god. And in order both to make peace with the people, as I've said, I think the Medo-Persians had a better idea than did the Babylonians and the Assyrians before them. Rather than uprooting everybody, they let them live where they are, have their own religion, have their own government, to an extent, okay, but pay taxes. You make for peace more willing subjects. But you are also seeking the favor of their local god. Because these idolaters believed in many gods, and superstitiously thought every city has its own god, so we want to be on good terms with all the gods, and if this is just another god, then we want to satisfy that god too, lest we get in trouble with him. So they just had this, let's make peace with all the gods, kind of a spirit, and that's what they're working on right here. The next thing is, pray for the life of the king and his sons. So beyond just the peace of the nation and placating a god that they sort of believe in, you know, we've got, pray for the life of the king and his sons. And so, again, there's kind of a tie that's being made there between the subjects and the kings, but you'll see they meant it. We would like for you, subject people, to appeal to your god on our behalf. Because they believe that there may be power behind every god, then they believe there's power behind Yahweh, whether they believe personally in Yahweh, Jehovah, or not. Okay, so very common. We find this in all the records. Not surprising at all. So in 11, I issued a decree that any man who violates this edict, a timber shall be drawn from his house, he shall be impaled on it, and his house shall be made a refuse heap on account of this. Oh. You know, when I got my building permit, I didn't have a clause like that one. So you guys, I'm issuing the permit. I'm also telling you, you're going to pay for it. I'm going to tell you how you're going to get the funds. It's out of the taxes, only from beyond the river, which likely means you know, on the western side of the Euphrates. Possibly the Jordan, we're not sure. But either way, you know, those taxes are going to pay anything they need. And he mentions specifically the sacrifices that will be needed at its dedication. So, in verse 12, and may the God who caused his name to dwell there overthrow any king or people who attempts to change it so as to destroy this house of God in Jerusalem. I, Darius, have issued a decree. Let it be carried out with all diligence. Now, let's take one more speculative step. I can't, you know, confirm this at all. But I've suggested this earlier. Suggested it with Daniel. I'm suggesting it again here with Ezra. What status did Daniel command for 65 years while he was in Babylon? Very high-ranking counselor to a succession of Babylonian kings throughout 70 years. Okay? Is Daniel familiar with the book of Isaiah? Did not Isaiah foretell, I think it's 140 years before he's born, that Cyrus was going to issue a decree for the people to rebuild? He did. When the records are found, hey, Cyrus did issue this decree. I suggested first with Daniel, Cyrus might have been pretty impressed when Daniel hands over in the book of Isaiah and says, welcome home, you know, we've been waiting for you for 70 years. Here you are, writing our ancient records. Well, that's impressive to the king. And probably would find its way into the archives. So here's this succession of kings now. We're down the road a couple of kings in Medo-Persia since Daniel's time. And they're looking at these records, you know, and saying, yeah, Cyrus gave that decree. You suppose Cyrus might have also included a reason why? It was his policy to send people back, but he had additional information, probably. Question, after Daniel lost his job as chief advisor to Babylonian kings, when the Babylonian kings were killed, the night the last one saw the handwriting on the wall and Daniel interpreted it for him, and the next day Cyrus showed up and conquered Babylon. All these things are going down. Daniel had what status in the Persian Empire? He was one of the three highest ranking officials who were at the top of 120 satrapies. Think, you know, provinces or counties maybe. But there are 120 of them. And Daniel didn't have just one of the 120. He was one of the three guys that these reported to. Okay? All the more reason for these kings to have records about that amazing guy, Daniel, who's one of these Jews. Maybe we ought to, you know, placate their God. So it's speculation. No scripture says this. But when you look at the circumstances, you know, it's pretty apparent that there's a high probability those records would contain this additional information and buttress Cyrus's reasoning. So the elders in verse let me see, where did I love you? Carried out with all diligence. 13. Then Tatnai, the governor beyond the river, Shethar-Boznai again, and their colleagues carried out the decree with all diligence, just as King Darius had sent. The elders of the Jews were successful in building through what? 14. The prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. They finished building according to the command of the God of Israel and the decree of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. And this temple was completed on the third day of the month Adar. It was the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. And the sons of Israel, the priests, the Levites, and the rest of the exiles celebrated the dedication of this house of God with joy. They offered for the dedication of this temple of God 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs. And as a sin offering for all Israel, 12 male goats corresponding to the number of the tribes of Israel. Then they appointed the priests to their divisions and the Levites in their orders for the service of God in Jerusalem, as it is written in the book of Moses, which they still had copies of after 70 years of captivity. Is that a pretty serious dedication? How many animals died? Yeah, I didn't even think to add that up myself. What do we got? 712. 712 animals died. Is that pretty big? That's pretty big. How many animals were offered at the dedication of Solomon's temple? According to 1 Kings 8 and verse 63, might want to write it in the margin, next to verse 17, put 1 Kings 8, 63. At Solomon's temple, there were 22,000 oxen that were sacrificed and another 12,000 sheep for a total of a whole lot of animals. More than the 712 that got dedicated here. When Solomon was building, in what state was the Jewish nation? They were at the top, as high as they would ever get. In fact, what happened immediately upon Solomon's death? Kingdom split in two. 10 tribes north, 2 tribes south. Civil war for the next 300 years. It's terrible. So they go only downhill from there. Now there'll be some great kings. I've stood at Samaria and the ruins of Ahab's palace. I've also been to Ahab's palace over how can I forget that place? Say again? Well, yeah, Samaria is the city I was just talking about. That's the first time I saw that was this year back in June. But, this is terrible. I'm really having a bad blank spot tonight. I can't draw the city out. But anyway, it is over in Jezreel. It's the Jezreel Valley. Jezreel. And so I've been in both places. There's nothing to see at Jezreel. But he was a magnificent and powerful king for the 10 northern tribes. And Jerusalem had been pretty well built by David and Solomon. You know, so they had some amazing things, but the kingdom split. Now they're not united. You know, things are going downhill. So now they're coming back. They're starting over. And no surprise, they're not coming back from 70 years captivity with anything like the numbers, the prosperity, the power that they had, you know, or that they had lost. So in 19... I'm sorry. Somebody have a hand up? Yeah.
Sabers
asked just a terrific question. I'm really glad you did, because I wanted to address that. I was forgetting completely. I was going to march on. So why are they representing 12 tribes when the 10 went off to disaster, never to return, you know, in their tribal or national sense, clear back in Isaiah's day at 722 B.C.? This is very close to 200 years later. Why recognize 12 tribes? Billy, you got a thought?
When Cyrus or Darius, whoever, whichever one, made the decree that everyone who was willing go back to Jerusalem, somewhere in there were people from those other 10 tribes. They had been spread out all over the place, I think dispersed, but anybody that was left could go. And these people were praying for the wealth of their whole nation.
So Bill has nailed it. Where do Samaritans come from? Survivors of the Assyrian invasion who were not taken into captivity. They succeeded in hiding out in the mountains or in the neighboring countries. And then they worked their way back in. Who did those Jews who escaped the Assyrian captivity marry as the years go by? The Gentiles, which are sent over to populate that region and pay their taxes and bring their crops in, so there are taxes. You know, those people are the Samaritans. Now, Samaritans, as time goes by, some of them, would they have also, before Babylon, let me get this straight, 700s B.C., before Assyria comes in 722 and actually wipes everything out, would not some of the tribal members of the 10 tribes in the north have fled down to Jerusalem, the most heavily defended city there is, for help when the Assyrians show up? Sure. And did the Assyrians surround the entire city of Jerusalem? Yeah. How many soldiers died in a single night? 185,000. Okay. But inside that city, you would have a significant number of the 10 tribes who would have fled there. Would there have been, third category, any group in the 10 tribes, any members up there, who would have thought, this is a bad idea for Jeroboam to be building golden calves up in Dan and Bethel? We don't like this idea at all. Would some have remained faithful to Yahweh? Sure, there's a third group. And might they have felt the need then to leave the 10 tribes and come on down to Jerusalem since they were being faithful? There's at least three groups of people. Would they know their tribal heritage? You bet they would. So 70 years are passed now. They've been keeping this up. You know, now they're coming home. I'm sorry, Bob. I think Ted had his hand up first, and then Bruce, and then you.
Amos, I think, who was sent to the northern tribe. Is that correct?
Amos, yes.
Yeah, and wasn't he told that there were faithful Israelites in the northern 10 tribes that he was preaching to?
Yeah, there you go. There you go. And so, even before Assyria comes in, there are people that are listening to the prophets, and they're heeding the prophets. You know. Now, let me just clarify. The 10 tribes are destroyed by Assyria. You know, they're transplanted. They never come back as recognizable, identifiable tribal entities. That does not mean that there weren't lots of people who didn't know what tribe they were from. The vast majority are wiped out or displaced, but they still know who they are. So there's the answer to Saber's question. Now, that's Ted. I think Bruce is next.
Quick group. Luke chapter 2, verse 36. Anna, the daughter of Phanuel, of the tribe of Asher.
There you go. Come clear down another 500 years later. You know, they still know there's a tribal member from Asher. Okay? And then Bob.
The reality is that all the different tribes don't need to be represented there in order to have a sacrifice made on their behalf. So there doesn't necessarily have to be someone from each tribe to make a sacrifice for all Israel.
See, that's exactly right. What Bob is suggesting is, even if there wasn't a single soul from any of those tribes there, would it still be appropriate to recognize God's 12 tribes going back to Abraham and his descendants and then, you know, a united kingdom? Well, sure. When they're coming back now, it's a united kingdom. So, your possibles and probable explanations. Bill, another comment.
It's a very, very old tradition, and we have an example of it in Job, that he prayed and sacrificed for all of his children.
Yeah, sure. No, there you go.
They were remembering the rest of their family, if nothing else.
Yeah, the Jews had a much greater sense of our forefathers, the fathers, you know, than we do today. Okay, now, looking at the time, I'd really like to do originally I'd hoped for, and I think I've got barely enough time to do it. So let's just finish chapter 6 in Ezra first, 19. The exiles observed the Passover on the 14th of the first month. You want to draw a line between verses 18 and 19 to got room and put end Aramaic. Remember, since 4 verse 8 down to here, it's in Aramaic. At verse 19, we go back to Hebrew. The exiles observe the Passover. Well, this is very Hebrew. So it's in the Hebrew language, 14th of the first month. Priests and the Levites had purified themselves together. All of them were pure. They slaughtered the Passover lamb for all the exiles, both for their brothers, the priests, and for themselves. Sons of Israel who returned from exile, and all those who had separated themselves from the impurity of the nations of the land to join them. These may be pure-blooded Gentiles. The Jews can be an impressive people. We'll find that in the New Testament. You got Cornelius and the centurion and others who recognize these Jews have a pretty great God and long records. So there are these that chose to join them. Well, that might be all Jews, but also might be some proselytes. to seek the Lord God of Israel, ate the Passover. They observed the Feast of Unleavened Bread, 7 days of joy, for the Lord had caused them to rejoice, had turned the heart of the king of Assyria toward them to encourage them in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. And again, don't let a reference to the king of Assyria throw you. Who's the current king of Assyria when these two chapters are written? Darius. But we say he's the king, the emperor of Medo-Persia. But what did he have to conquer to become that? Babylon. Well, he didn't, but he's a descendant thereof. And what had to happen before that? Babylon had to conquer Assyria. So the region that is known as Assyria has been ruled by Syrians and Assyrians and Babylonians and now Medo-Persians. So he's that king. Okay, so you know, again, not a problem. Okay, here's what I'd like everybody to do. Please open now to Zechariah. Zechariah is the next to last, Haggai. Turn to Haggai. Zechariah is the next to last book in the Old Testament. But Haggai is this tiny little book. It's just in front of him. So you find Zechariah, Malachi, you back up just enough to get to Haggai. And what I'd like to do tonight is similar to what we did on Sunday night. I read 8 chapters of Zechariah on Sunday night. And in so doing, we saw a little over half of that prophet's book. That is the Zechariah that stimulated the building of this temple after they'd let it lapse for 16 years. Ultimately, it took 4.5 years of building to get it done. So these prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, they motivated the people to do it. And the records of both of them are written in separate books. And as you look at Haggai now, how long is Haggai? Really tiny little book. But it belongs right here. Because of his work and Zechariah's, they have just dedicated this temple in chapter 6. So let's read his book, Haggai chapter 1 and verse 1. This would be 520 B.C. and probably September or October. 520 B.C. In the second year of Darius the king, on the first day of the sixth month, the word of the Lord came by the prophet Haggai to Zerubbabel, whose other name is Sheshbazzar, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, saying, thus says Yahweh of hosts, this people says, the time has not come, the time for the house of the Lord to be rebuilt. Then the word of Yahweh came by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses, while this house lies desolate? Now therefore, thus says Yahweh of hosts, consider your ways. You've sown much, but harvest little. You eat, but not enough to be satisfied. You drink, but there's not enough to become drunk. You put on clothing, but no one's warm. And he who earns wages to put into a purse with holes. Well, then what are you doing with your money? You're losing it. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountains, bring wood, and rebuild the temple, that I may be pleased with it and be glorified, says Yahweh. You look for much, but behold, it comes to little. When you bring it home, I blow it away. Why, declares Yahweh of hosts? Because of my house, which lies desolate, while each of you runs to his own house. Therefore, because of you, the sky has withheld its dew and the earth has withheld its produce. And I called for a drought on the land, on the mountains, on the grain, on the new wine, on the oil, on what the ground produces, on men, on cattle, and on all the labor of your hands. And then Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of Yahweh their God in the words of Haggai the prophet, as Yahweh their God had sent him. And the people showed reverence for Yahweh. Then Haggai, the messenger of Yahweh, spoke by the commission of Yahweh to the people, saying, I am with you, declares Yahweh. So the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people that came and worked on the house of Yahweh of hosts, their God, on the 24th day of the sixth month, in the second year of Darius the king. On the 21st of the seventh month, the word of the Lord came by Haggai the prophet, saying, "Speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and the remnant of the people, saying, Who is left among you who saw this temple in its former glory? And how do you see it now? Does it not seem to you like nothing in comparison? But now, take courage, Zerubbabel, declares Yahweh. Take courage also, Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and all you people of the land. Take courage, declares Yahweh, and work, for I am with you, says Yahweh of hosts. As for the promise which I made you when you came out of Egypt, my spirit is abiding in your midst. Do not fear. For thus says Yahweh of hosts, once more, in a little while, I'm going to shake the heavens and the earth, the sea also, and the dry land. And I will shake all the nations. They will come with the wealth of all nations. I will fill this house with glory, says Yahweh of hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, declares Yahweh of hosts. The latter glory of this house will be greater than the former, says Yahweh of hosts. And in this place I shall give peace, declares the Lord of hosts. Now the 2 months and 3 days later, at verse 10. On the 24th of the ninth month, in the second year of Darius, the word of the Lord came to Haggai the prophet, saying, Thus says Yahweh of hosts, Ask now the priests for a ruling. If a man carries holy meat in the fold of his garment, and touches bread with this fold, or cooked food, wine, oil, or any other food, will it, that is, the holy meat inside the fold, will it become holy? The priest answered and said, No. And then Haggai said, If one who is unclean from a corpse touches any of these, will the latter become unclean? And the priest answered and said, It will become unclean. But now, do consider from this day onward, before one stone was placed on another in the temple of Yahweh, from that time, when one came to a grain heap of 20 measures, there'd be only 10. When one came to the wine vat to draw 50 measures, there'd be only 20. I smote you, every work of your hands, with blasting wind, mildew, and hail, yet you did not come back to me, declares Yahweh. Do consider from this day onward, from the 24th day of the ninth month, from the day when the temple of the Lord was founded, consider, is the seed still in the barn? Even including the vine, the fig tree, the pomegranate, the olive tree, it has not borne fruit. Yet from this day on, I will bless you. Then the word of the Lord came a second time to Haggai on the 24th day of the month. He got two prophecies that day. Speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I am going to shake the heavens and the earth. I will overthrow the thrones of kingdoms and destroy the power of the kingdoms of the nations. And I will overthrow the chariots and their riders, and the horses and their riders will go down every one by the sword of another. On that day, declares Yahweh of hosts, I will take you, Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, my servant, declares Yahweh, I will make you like a signet ring, for I have chosen you, declares Yahweh of hosts. Now there's the prophecies that got these people up and running. And there is also insight into something that Ezra never tells you about. What had these people been experiencing during the course of these last 16 years? They'd all gone and built their own paneled houses, nice places. But what? Do they have enough wine? Do they have enough food? Do they have enough money? No. Did they have drought? Did they have, you know, plagues on the crops? Mildew, all kinds of problems. Yet you what? You didn't come back to me. So that's why you've been suffering. And now Haggai and Zechariah are here to say, have you learned your lesson yet? And had they? Yeah, we get it. All right, let's build. And off they went. So after a 16-year lapse, in 516 A.D., they rededicated a temple that had been torn down precisely how many years earlier? 70. Exactly what Jeremiah said in chapter 25 and 29 of his book. Exactly what God said. So, 70 years without the temple. 16 years after they started building it, took Zechariah and Haggai to fulfill the prophecy by motivating these people. Brethren, to the work.